Let's go over the requirements that wireless sensor networks have in the environmental sensing application. And we've already talked about battery life and we've talked about invasiveness. For this application, we also need two more things. We need scientific accuracy. So it's not an academic toy for engineers, it's actually a system. A measurement system or an instrument used by scientists, and also for that reason, it needs to be able to use a lot of different probes or transducers. We'd like to support incremental deployment. And what we mean by that is you might put out 10 nodes, and then maybe the following year you would like to add 10 more, and you'd like the network to just keep working and those extra nodes to just join in essentially transparently. Over here, we talk about scalability. What we're talking about here is we'd like the sensor network technology to work whether the area is small or large. So maybe 100 square meters up to square kilometers. And also, we care about density too. You'd like to be able to put them close together or far apart, and the same technology should work. As far as life cycle costs, so let me go to right there. That's really, really big. And related to that is ease of installation and maintenance. If these aren't well done, then your life cycle cost is going to go up, and that will make sensor networks less economically feasible. And then finally, a couple extras here. You'd like to be able to go take the data directly to the internet, and you'd like this thing to last a long time in harsh environments. Let's take a look at what the hardware of a sensor node looks like. This is fairly typical. This is a NAU Wizard. It's a little bit older model, but it gets the idea across. Let's first take a look here. It's located in a weatherproof polycarbonate box. On either side of the stack of circuit boards are two battery packs. This particular node design has internal batteries to power it. But you can see here, and also you can see a little bit here, there's a bottom board in this two-board stack here. And both of these are what we call sensor data acquisition boards or SD boards. And they manage the transducers or the actual sensors, such as temperature sensors, soil moisture sensors, light, that kind of thing. Attached to that, and you can see that here and also here, is what we call our brain board. And that has a microcontroller that controls the activity of the entire sensor. And the brain board connects via a cable, which you can't see here, to this board, which is the radio board, and that's located in the lid of this box. And there's an antenna coming out the other side. And so you can see there's a three-board stack, if you will, even though the top two are connected by a cable. And it's also a dual processor architecture, and that means that there is a microcontroller on the SD board, and that is used to manage the activities. Or I should say, it's to manage the transducers, such as soil moisture or light sensors. And there's also a brain, I'm sorry, there's also a microcontroller on the brain, and that microcontroller is right here, which again manages the activity of the entire sensor. Here are some highlights of the WizardNet design. There's a lot of information on this slide, but we'll try to break it down a little bit. Since we're electrical engineers, we can immediately get a sense of the communication and networking. And the WizardNet uses the industrial, scientific, and medical band just below 1 gigahertz. We use frequency shift keying modulation, and we use a frequency hopping type of spread spectrum. in coordination with a radio sharing algorithm called CRMA. And this is a joint physical and media access control algorithm to minimize interference and facilitate efficient sharing of the radio channel. And we'll talk about that more later on in the lectures. Let me move to self-organization. I alluded to this earlier when we talked about incremental deployments, and here's where you would like to add, move, delete nodes, or maybe replace a node that had failed. And this has to do with something that's known as self-healing networks. And this is an active research area, but the idea is that the network can recover from failures or changes autonomously, that is, without any human intervention. Over on the right column, we have a set of functions here that are all implemented in the embedded software that is resident on the microcontroller in the brain of the wizard. We do power management. There's a scheduler that determines exactly what and when all the activities of the sensor are scheduled for. And we can also save energy by turning on what's called dynamic reporting. And here is where we report only significant changes. And finally, because this is a scientific instrument, it has to be very usable out in the field. So it has a fairly comprehensive user interface so that, for example, in the field, you can take a wizard, plug in a PC, and reconfigure it. Wireless sensor networks are what we call networked embedded systems. So each sensor node is an embedded system, and that's short for an embedded computing system. And the embedded means just that it is linked or coupled to the physical world through various transducers and interfaces. And this is to distinguish it from non-embedded or interactive systems like your desktop or laptop computer. So embedded systems have inputs and outputs, and we'll talk about those just a little bit. The interfaces to the external world through transducers are quite a few. All of these are basically mediated by analog to digital conversion, but you can see here we measure temperature and we measure light. The kind of light we measure is PAR, which stands for photosynthetically active radiation. We also measure soil moisture using more general purpose probe channels. And we can also do serial communication with smarter transducers or probes. And we actually are able to interface it with a smart weather station. And also we can measure sap flux. And this is the flow of liquid in the tree in tree trunks. We also have the ability to interface with other types of nodes. And finally, as far as inputs, we have a provision for external energy supplies. And we actually have hooked up wizards to solar panels so that they can be powered continuously without needing to change the battery. Here's an example of what the data looks like from a wireless sensor network. And this was a deployment north of the San Francisco Peaks in northern Arizona in a grasslands area. And we actually measured temperature over several days. And we measured temperature in the soil and in the air in sunny and shaded plots. And you can see the difference here between the soil temperature, which is the smooth in the blue, and the air temperature, which is much more jaggedy, because the soil actually provides a sort of capacitance, if you will, to temperature, smoothing out the variations that you see. There are a number of different wireless sensor network and node technologies out there. We'll talk about just a few to give you a flavor here. Here we see three specific sensor node designs from the academic or research community. The BT nodes from ETH Zurich in Switzerland, the MOTES that were originated in UC Berkeley and now have a number of commercial derivatives, and to compare the one you've seen already, the WizardNet at NAU. Like I said, they do differ in hardware and software and in radio design. For example, the MOTES tend to work with 2.4 gigahertz radios rather than 915 megahertz radios. And they have different philosophies in the software used to control the activity of the node. And these are continuously being developed. There are a number of commercial sensor network technologies coming online. I've listed three here. The first is a MicroStrain, and it's a 2.4 gigahertz node design using a simple single hop or star technology. There's also a company called Crossbow, which has a sensor node called Eco, which has been designed for precision agriculture applications. So this would be used, for example, in vineyards where you're carefully controlling how much water the grapevines are getting. And finally, there is a high-powered node from a company called National Instruments, and in cooperation with a group at UCLA. It's very, very capable in terms of what it can do, but it's also very expensive, and because it uses essentially Wi-Fi, it uses a lot of battery power as well. Now that we've seen a sample of the cost of wireless sensor nodes, let's think bigger about the economics of wireless sensor networks for the environmental monitoring application. And the first question we're going to ask is, are they viable? Does the economics make sense? And even more broadly, or more fundamentally, we're going to ask, are they necessary? Are there other technologies that we can also use that might be cheaper? Let's take a look at how much a sensor node actually costs. And this table I put together is an estimate of the cost. And most importantly, I think, we can see that the cost per node is about $500. And this is assuming that the stuff that actually goes inside the sensor node box is only about $70. And as you can see, most of the cost comes from looking at the transducers. The transducers tend to dominate the cost. And so roughly, if you need 100 nodes, this would be about $50,000, plus a little bit of change for the a site weather station, which would measure, for example, wind speed and velocity. So keep in mind that this would be for about 100 nodes. And that might seem a lot, like a lot, but it's only about a 10 by 10 array if you scatter them uniformly in a lattice. So it's not a very large network to get you up to around $60,000. And most importantly, that's not the whole picture. There are other costs as well. We may not want to measure just light, temperature, and soil moisture. What if we wanted to measure things like trunk growth, or leaf respiration, or use eddy covariance to measure the exchange of CO2 between the plants and the atmosphere, or measure the velocity of sap in a tree trunk? All these things will add to the cost. And so this number that I kicked around, which is about $60,000 for a 10 by 10 array, is really on the low side because it doesn't include all the other things that you might want to do. Given that, how does this scale up? So let's suppose we had the idea that we're going to monitor the planet. And there are a number of activities or initiatives on the way to look at this, so it's a relevant problem. So let's start out with something on the order of $100 million. And that is a reasonable number, we think, to give you a comparison. A satellite is about $300 million. And in this case, for this example, it's the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, which unfortunately did not make it to orbit last year. And let's assume that we have $100 million again, and that each sensor is $100, and that we put 2 per hectare. And a hectare is 100 meter by 100 meter area. So 2 per hectare is probably on the low side. Currently, we have quite a bit more. So how far do you think your $100 million would go? Well, if you look at this map of Colorado, all the green spots are wilderness areas that you might want to instrument to understand, for example, climate change. So it turns out that $100 million will allow you to monitor just one of these wilderness areas, and that is it. So one wilderness area in one state, in one nation, that's $100 million. So we can clearly see a need for improvements in the technology. We mentioned satellites, and actually they're a very, very good idea. Although the OCO didn't make it to orbit because of a launch failure, there are other satellites. For example, the Terra satellite, terra.nasa.gov, is part of NASA's Earth Observing System, and it's a very capable satellite. It has multiple sensors on board. It can measure the surface temperature and reflectivity. It can measure the scattering of radiation in the atmosphere, cloud properties, the type of land cover, like plants and vegetation, and sea ice extent, among many other things. So these satellites are incredible and doing a great job, and they also have the advantage that one satellite in the right orbit can cover the entire planet. But unfortunately, a satellite doesn't give the complete picture. First of all, it's very useful to have ground truth data. So sensors on the ground, observations on the ground to validate and calibrate the data coming from the satellite. For certain sorts of things, you also need under canopy measurements. But what I mean by that is that in some frequency bands, it's difficult for the satellite to see through the tree canopy. Also, we might be interested in biotic responses, and that might include sap flux, for example, in an individual tree. We'll talk about that here. And for that, you have to actually be at the tree making those measurements. And the same thing is true for leaf-based measurements, because clearly, if you're trying to understand plant growth, you need to understand photosynthesis, and therefore you need to understand the flow of gases in and out of leaves and the flow of sap in the trunk of a tree. So the bottom line is that we actually would like to have both. We need both satellites and terrestrial sensing to create a better understanding and models of what's happening here on the planet.